when they didn't even have my name on the list.
I'm just kidding.
Well, I always like to start on time, because I think folks that start on, you know, or arrive on time, just, I don't know, always taught that way. So my name is John Batsis. I'm one of the geriatricians at Hitchcock and one of the faculty members here at the Aging Center. And wear a lot of hats, but this is one of them, kind of giving some talks to folks such as yourselves here. And hopefully what I'd like to do in the next hour or so is tell you a little bit about my interests in muscle. And why muscle? Well, muscle's important in the aging process, and I'm going to really focus on why it's important. And for some folks that are here who are my patients, you've heard me kind of mentioning the get the Campbell soup cans and do 10 or 12 reps of that. And then in the second part of my talk, kind of give a little bit about some strategies to improve muscle strength. And feel free at any point to stop me, interrupt me, saying, what are you talking about? I'm confused, or this is great, keep on going, whatever you'd like. But please don't throw any tomatoes.
You get too much lycopene, we can't do that.
So I usually, whenever I give a talk, I always start off with my tsunami slide. Mm-hmm. And why do I put this up? Well, because our society is changing. Our demographic is changing. Folks are living longer, and the population over the age of 65 in the United States and elsewhere is actually one of the fastest growing, if not the fastest growing segment of the population. Those over the age of 80 are actually the fastest growing segment. So that's why I use this as an analogy, because it's a tsunami. It's hitting everybody. And unfortunately, our society is really not prepared in terms of community resources, healthcare resources, et cetera, the list goes on, in terms of the changing demographic. So this is some recent census data. So as you know, the US has their census every 10 years, most recently done in 2010. And you can see that folks over the age of 65 account for 40 million persons. And what the Census Bureau likes to do is they like to project. And they're actually not too bad in terms of projecting where population trends are going. So what you can see here in the year 2060, there's almost going to be a doubling of the population over the age of 65. You know, over 90 million folks are going to be over the age of 65. And again, our society really hasn't really taken that into account, not only, again, from social resources, but also healthcare resources. And put in another way, looking at what percent of folks are over the age of 65. Right now, about 13% of people in the United States are age 65 and older. And that's going to be over 20%, 22%. So this is a real public health concern, in the sense that we need to get folks to start listening to kind of tailor programs accordingly.
Just out of curiosity, yeah. Isn't the baby boomer generation sort of like trailing off by 2060? Is that because the birth rate would be going down?
So birth rate is going down right
so
now.
You can sort of see that.
Stable.
Right.
But because folks are living longer, and okay. I'll show you some slides here on life expectancy in a few minutes.
Yeah.
But the proportion, it just general population trends show.
So once it reaches that kind of ratio,
it may plateau.
Right, yeah. Gotcha.
And as I mentioned earlier, this is the proportion of folks over the age of 85. And you can see there's, again, over 4.5%, which you think, well, what's 4.5%? That's a small percentage. But when you put it in absolute numbers, we're talking in the millions. So, life expectancy. I imagine, say, folks who were 65 years of age, perhaps, if it was folks at the age of 65 in the year 1950. Social Security, was developed in the 60s and based on life expectancy measures. So folks, at that point, were living maybe 10 to 15 years. Fast forward to 2010. If you're 65 years of age in the year 2010, if you're male, you're going to live another 18 years on average. If you're female, you're going to live another 21 years on average. And these estimates are continuing to rise. Why is that? Well, we have advances in medical care. In particularly over the last 2 to 3 decades, you've had a number of people who have benefited from medical therapies from heart disease. So the rates of heart disease are actually stabilizing, if not starting to decrease. And cancer actually is now going to overcome heart disease as the biggest killer in the United States. Okay, so you're probably saying, where's this guy going? So the reason I say that, I was kind of giving some background in terms of the demographic trends, is because 2-3 decades ago, folks were independent, living independently in their own lives, and then they had a short period of disability before they passed on. In the current day and age, this period of normal function is actually a little longer. But this period of disability, you're at a higher risk of having some kind of disability over time. Because you're living longer, and because you're living longer, you're increased at risk, more medical problems and the like. And then at that point, folks pass on. So it's really kind of the wheels of life, as I like to call it. I always like to interject a couple of funny things to kind of keep the humor going. So, as many of you in this room may be aware, as you age, you develop medical problems. That's, unfortunately, it's part of the aging process. And this is one study that really showed that as folks age in different age brackets, you look at the far right bar, which is the kind of the orange reddish bar, those are the folks over the age of 90, they have a high proportion of medical problems. So I used the word function a couple slides ago, and I just to kind of make sure everybody's on the same page, I always like to kind of explain what I talk about function. ADLs, that's kind of the coined term, or activities of daily living. This is what I mean. Basic activities of daily living is essentially everything everybody does first thing in the morning. So you're in bed, you transfer out of bed, you walk, you bathe, you toilet, you dress yourself, and you feed yourself. Instrumental activities of daily living. When I talk to my residents and my medical students, I say, well, it's everything you do on your day off. So you're shopping, you're housekeeping, you're preparing meals, taking your medications, finances. You can get folks to help you stay in your home as long as possible to do a lot of these instrumental activities of daily living, the IADLs as I like to call them. Basic activities of daily living, you can get folks to help you, but this is what often leads to folks needing a higher level of care and or institutionalization. So I just kind of wanted to put this slide up just to kind of get everybody on a kind of level playing field. And why is this important? So this is one study that actually showed the trends with disability over time. So as folks age, if you live to your tail end of that is 110 years of age, actually the world's oldest person has lived to 126, they will have compromisation of all their activities of daily living, basic activities of daily living. If you live long enough, just the body is just unable to compensate. And really, the first ADL that really kind of starts getting compromised, and compromised, I'm not saying that you can't do it, but you have difficulty with doing, is walking. And actually, feeding is usually the last to go. Again, disease specific, certain diseases may be more affected than others. So I have some folks that see me very rarely. So if I don't go to the doctor, he can't find anything wrong with me. That's how I stay healthy. So kind of switching gears here a little bit more. As there are many changes that occur with aging. And many changes, and when I mean aging, I mean from infancy to adolescence to early adulthood to late adulthood to older adulthood. and again, I'm focusing on the on older adults. As one ages, there's you actually gain fat as you age, fat mass, and you lose fat-free mass. Now, when I mean fat-free mass, that's muscle, for all intents and purposes. So that's a natural change that occurs. And so as one ages, there's really a redistribution of what your body composition really is. So these are my little kids a couple of years back, and as they're flexing their muscles, and you can see they, you know, they don't really have much muscle on them, although they think they're Superman sometimes.
Yes.
Look at Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh boy.
So back in the day, the very disturbing picture on the left, you can see he's really the muscle man here. And the current, when he just was as a governor of California, he had really lost a lot of his muscle. So even someone as physically fit as him will lose muscle mass. So I think this is a really fun slide to kind of go through. And why do I say that? Because, so if for those of you who didn't know, because I was one of them until I found this, there's something called the World Masters Games Record. So this is basically at every age, folks bench press and lift weights. And you can see the amount, those in the ages age category of 35 to 39, a gentleman from Hungary, he was able to lift 295 kilograms. So that's almost 660 pounds.
Oh my God.
That's exactly what I said. I'm like, boy, I can barely lift 50 pounds. But you can see, these are the world record holders. So as folks age, look at the column on the far right. So there's a natural tendency that you can't lift. The muscles don't work as well with age.
That explains it.
So when folks come to me and say, well, I'm weaker than I was, there are many reasons for weakness, of course. But from a muscle standpoint, there is natural loss of muscle mass with age. And this, I think, this slide kind of sums it almost all of it up, because it really proves to us that, well, folks don't have that ability to bench press as much. Not that many of us would go bench pressing 90 kilograms, but it just kind of gives you an indication. So, hence the topic of sarcopenia. And I throw this term to you folks, I throw this term to my colleagues, and my colleagues look at me with an empty look and say, what are you talking about? So I pull out my handy dictionary. Now, you may or may not know I'm of Greek origin, so I always love dissecting words. They always, of course, if anyone's seen the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding, everything comes from a Greek word. So sarcopenia, from the word flesh. Penia means loss. So really, it's coined as the loss of muscle mass and quality that occurs with aging. And this is actually a relatively new term.
Who coined it? The Greek guy.
It was a German guy, believe it or not. As a lot of the medical terms, half are Latin-based, half are Greek-based. And so I had a distinct advantage, I think, going through medical school, because I knew half the words right off the bat. I just had to learn, and the Latin ones, a lot of them were French, so I knew a lot of the French words, so I was in good shape. But really, this is what the term means. When you talk about sarcopenia, this is what is the loss of muscle mass and quality that occurs with aging. So really, you know, it's like the stock market. It just sometimes goes up, but most of the time, when it goes down, you get worried about it. So this is probably one of my most important slides. I'm going to spend some time, and really, if there are any questions, please, again, feel free to stop me. So it's a life course. So in early life, my kids, for instance, there's growth and development of muscle mass. So you gain muscle mass. And by the early, mid to late 20s, that's actually your peak muscle mass. So I've missed the boat. Many of you have missed the boat. A lot of my younger cousins have missed the boat. So the age you want to try to build up your muscle as best as you can in your early adulthood. And what is the goal in adult life? In adult life, of course, ranges. It really is to maintain this peak. So the importance of engaging in regular physical activity cannot be understated. It's so important.
What you said the goal was again? What was that word you used?
The
goal of age of adulthood, or
is to maintain.
Maintain.
Yep.
Okay.
So maintaining the peak, this peak muscle mass. And in older adulthood, really, it's to minimize the loss. You know that you will lose muscle mass and muscle quality, so the goal is to try to halt this. How do you do that? Well, before you do that, you know that there's a threshold. Once you lose a given amount of muscle mass and muscle quality, and you cross this threshold, disability kicks in. Whatever type of loss of function that may be, of those ADLs that we talked about. So the goal really is to use the environment to change this threshold. Okay? So it's going to take a longer period of time for you to reach that threshold. So one of the reasons why you lose, that you get weaker with age, is you remember I mentioned that you gain fat mass as you age? Well, part of this fat mass actually goes into your muscles, believe it or not. So this is a CAT scan here of a healthy adult on the left in their 30s and an older adult in their 80s. So you can even just, not even needing to be a radiologist here, look at the differences. So fat is basically that white stuff here. You see the arrow there? And all that interspersed here. So when you get fat that goes into the muscle, that impairs and harms muscle quality. So, you have this concept of sarcopenia. This is actually when folks start getting weaker because of that. That's kind of a prelude to frailty. And have all of you heard of kind of the term frailty before? And that really is a prelude to disability. So it's kind of it's a continuum, meaning one leads to another, which leads to another. So you want to prevent getting down to the far right here. So a couple of data slides here. How do you go about defining this? And this is something that I've worked on, and let me tell you, it's not easy. There are three different consensus statements, meaning in the scientific literature, three different organizations have tried to define this, and guess what? You got three different answers. So, you know, going to Dr. Dolkart, for instance, say, Dr. D, I want you to test me for sarcopenia. And he's going to say, well, we don't have a good test for that. And he's right. But it exists, and we all recognize it. So that's one of the challenges that researchers are trying to figure out. How do you get this into our clinic? Because it's such an important phenomenon that we need to be able to measure it. You know, we can measure osteoporosis, right? We can measure blood pressure. Very, a little bit harder to test for this. So there are some things that we can try to identify folks. Gait speed, so this is walking speed. We don't do this all too often in our clinic, and only in folks that we think that doing this will change ultimately how we'll manage folks. But we basically get folks to walk down about 20 feet and time them. And if they use a cane, let them use a cane. If they use a walker, let them use a walker. And there are some metrics here. If you're less than 1 meter per second, then you're at high risk, and it increases the likelihood that you have this sarcopenia phenomenon. There's another thing that the cardiologists often do, and the lung doctors actually do, in lung and heart patients, called the six-minute walk. And that's exactly what that is. They get you to walk around a track for 6 minutes, and they see how far you can walk. This last bullet there is a little bit more mathematical, as I like to call it. And that the only way you can measure someone's, when we talk about appendicular muscle mass. That means arms and legs. The only way to do that is to do fancy tests, which unfortunately no insurance company and or Medicare will ever cover at this stage. So we're kind of stuck from that standpoint. So I put this was my honeymoon picture in Rome, and I figure I had to, again, put some pictures in here. So what we do know is sarcopenia is age-associated. There's no doubt from researchers and clinicians that this concept is age-associated, and it's complex. Well, that doesn't really help us, right? But it really is, it's an interplay between loss of muscle mass and potentially increase in the fat mass that you saw in that CAT scan. So there's something that's going on there that's kind of leading to worsening function. And of course they use a nice little, I like these buzzwords, multifactorial, i.e. due to many, 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 many reasons, which I'm not going to go through here. So we know it's age associated, we know it's multifactorial, and we know it's complex. So another working group is trying to kind of figure out how do you get this into the clinic. And we know that there are some ways that you can measure muscle mass. There are some ways you can measure muscle strength. There are some devices where you can call that you can test for grip strength. So you kind of squeeze, see a little needle goes up, and that kind of gives you an indicator as to how strong. I'm hoping that we're going to get that in our clinic within the next 6 months to be able to actually track folks' strength, because I think that's extremely important.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm hoping I haven't confused you thus far. But I wanted to take a 1 minute time out just to make sure if any questions, clarifications, or like.
I got a question. So the grip of your hand is related to maybe your leg muscles?
Could be.
Oh.
Yep, it could be.
But PT departments have those now.
Absolutely.
And you can't cross over and borrow them, or you want.
And
to
I think one of the challenges I can speak for our own practice is there's so many things that we want to do and so many competing priorities.
Yeah.
As geriatricians, we have our own agenda, so to speak. You know, to try to, you know, these are so important in being able to kind of inform patient care. I think we're getting there. I'm here 5.5 years. Where we were 5.5 years ago, we're miles ahead of that.
Good.
So,
yeah. I thought of something probably way off base. Does what we eat have anything to do with loss or regaining muscle mass?
Great question. And that's going to be my little teaser.
Okay.
I'm going to have you hold that thought.
Okay.
Any other questions so far?
I have one more question.
Yeah.
Just in terms of its sort of kind of general kind of experience for everyone is going to experience sarcopenia, you as well, even though you're a geriatrician, you're not immune.
Unless nobody's, I find the fountain of life. For
exactly. So nobody's immune to it. So how this muscle loss progresses is really almost an individual thing, or is it something we can control? We have. Is it largely in our control?
So I'm going to go through what some of the causes are.
Okay.
There are a number of things that are in our control.
Okay.
And some are not.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm a very kind of visual / kind of methodical, if this then that kind of person. So I apologize for those of you who are not. But so when I think about sarcopenia, there's age related. So stuff or is going to happen that is not under your control, as we just described. There is what we call secondary sarcopenia. So this is things that either because you're not moving, you're not eating properly, or due to different diseases, that, you know, if you get those managed, maybe that'll slow down the loss of muscle mass, so get more in your control. So some causes of sarcopenia. So muscle turnover, what does that mean? For those of you who've been in the hospital, if you're not moving in the hospital, sit, you try to get out of bed, your muscles have atrophied. They basically, you know, they're sleeping. and trying to get up and mobilize is very difficult. And that's why, you know, we try to engage folks in ambulating 3 times a day, you know, while they're in the hospital. Because, you know, the worst thing you can do is to lie in bed, because that'll get you weaker. Physical inactivity. I try to get my mom to, who's, you know, to do some exercise. You know, she's retired, has her grandchildren fine, but she doesn't exercise and she doesn't do some muscle strengthening, and it drives me bananas. But, you know, no one listens to their, she doesn't listen to her son, so. it's payback, I guess, right? Malnutrition. So, and this is what we'll get to, some things that we can do from a nutritional standpoint.
Could you explain muscle turnover versus physical activity?
So muscle
You mean you're regenerating muscle?
So this is the thing, is that, you know, when you're, if you're immobile, say,
right,
for whatever reason, and you try to kind of engage yourself again into physical activity, you may or may not reach the previous level of function.
Okay.
A great example for that is, say, someone who sustains a hip fracture.
Okay.
A huge proportion of folks who sustain a hip fracture will not regain their previous level of function. Only about a quarter of folks at 1 year will regain their previous level of function.
Wow.
Yeah. Changes in neuromuscular function. What does that mean? More neurologic diseases, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. That's really not in folks' control. Smoking, something hugely in everybody's control. Okay, and this actually, smoking increases inflammation in your body, and inflammation can lead to muscle breakdown and muscle impairment and muscle quality.
If someone smoked and then quit, does that affect sarcopenia?
So when you think about that, it shifts the curve. So, So say I have, say it's like that, this is like the normal and non-smoker. And say this is the smoker, and then they stop smoking. Versus if they smoked.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, yes, that's what I wanted to
know. And very similarly with, like, lung function, you'll lose lung function when you smoke, but after a period of time, the rate of change is going to be the same as a non-smoker. But unfortunately, the damage has been done.
Yeah, because you are always listed, if you were a smoker, you are always listed in the medical record as a smoker, even if you haven't smoked in 30 or 40 years.
Yep. It's there, okay. Unfortunately, because the damage has been done. Unfortunately, you can't change your genes. So, one of my great aunt lived to, she was 106. She was doing the Greek jig till 104. She didn't have a cane. She didn't have a walker. She was in better physical shape than
your mom.
It just was. My mom's not too bad, but you know, genes. She had good genes. There's no doubt about it. And I put this as kind of an umbrella term, inflammatory changes. This basically means a lot of different diseases can affect this. So there's a whole slew of things that can affect, okay? I'll be testing this, by the way, at the end of the, so expect you all to know that. Okay, just kidding. So what happens with strength? We've talked about muscle mass quite a bit here, but what happens with strength over time? And this is really an interesting study that showed that muscle strength over a 3-year period of time in those between the ages of 70 to 79 actually drops considerably. So that's important because then there's a natural change in muscle strength. So if you're 70 and you do nothing, you don't do any physical exercises, at the age of 73, you're going to be weaker. Just natural history. So again, that part of that is in your control. And this is grip strength. And there's a lot of, like, bless you, a lot of kind of like not quite comprehensible dots here, but you see the general trend is kind of a downwards trend. And what does that mean? Again, grip strength, using that dynamometer, which is that little device that the PTs use, it shows that it just drops with age. Throw in obesity. We all know that we have a public health crisis of obesity in this country. You know, over 35% of our older adult population has obesity. Obesity and low muscle strength is a bad outcome at the end of the day. It leads to worsened disability. Okay. So what? This is probably the biggest reason, a patient-centered reason. It leads to disability. And we know disability leads to impaired quality of life and institutionalization and just bad outcomes at the end of the day. Increased risk of death. So I have a study that's in press or had been submitted right now that showed that those with sarcopenia are at higher risk for dying. So having a low muscle mass and low muscle quality increases one's risk of death. I had to put this in because we were at Dartmouth, and Dartmouth talks about healthcare costs all the time. But it's associated with increase in healthcare costs. There was a study that was done, five or six years ago that showed those with sarcopenia had on average $2,000 more costs per year than those that didn't. You think $2,000? What's that? That's not much. That's small change. But think about the number of people with sarcopenia. Now you're talking to billions.
I thought we all had it.
But that leads to disability.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know, I didn't go through the details of like various grades of sarcopenia.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
There's further. I wanted to kind of just keep that simple.
All right.
The other thing that patients with LOMA with sarcopenia are at risk of falling, and I know our center here is very big on, you know, fall prevention measures, but this is hugely important because once folks fall, it leads to fewer falling, and it leads to hip fractures. So this is a problem. And it actually, there's some evidence that it shows that those with low muscle mass and low muscle strength are at higher risk of infections, believe it or not. If you ask me why, I don't know the answer to that. So we talked a little bit about disability. What I mean by that, impaired walking, climbing, lifting, standing, increased need for help at home. And increased risk of death. We talked about the strength. Okay. So just to make things a little bit more complicated, we talked a little bit about obesity, but kind of formalize this here. I'm not sure if many of you have seen these maps, but these are maps that are published by the Centers for Disease Control that show obesity trends in the last 30 years. So you can see the colors are getting redder and redder. So over 30% of those states, and this is usually more the southern states here, have a high prevalence of obesity. Vermont's not doing too badly, nor is New Hampshire. Their rates are actually in the lower tier in the country. But still, nonetheless, it's still a huge problem. And older adults are not immune to this. Now imagine this. You have folks with sarcopenia, okay, who meet given thresholds, and folks with obesity. So you have low muscle mass and strength, and you have increased fat mass. Put those together, it's a lose-lose combination. So folks who meet those two criteria are in really big trouble. Their risk of disability is actually higher than those with just obesity or just sarcopenia. And this is a study I actually published, which we looked at, given rates of this sarcopenic obesity phenomenon, which basically we showed that it increases with age, and the rates are very dependent on the definition. Remember I mentioned earlier in the a little while ago that there are no standardized definitions? Well, this is, we proved this in this study. Okay, so sarcopenia, obesity, it's a lose-lose combination. But we need more data. And how do we treat this? This is what we don't know how to do effectively at this point. So, I'm hoping I've scared you thus far. So let's go back to the clinic. Has anyone read this book? Execution?
It's not Capital Punishment.
It's actually a great book that I read during my fellowship. That it basically says, how do you get things done in an organization? So, these are the folks that I think we identify as high risk. So without having standardized definitions, we are now in our clinic screening patients who come in, not only for mood, not only for quality of life, but also for falls. Have you fallen in the last year on that purple sheet? If patients tell me, you know what, I'm walking slower. A number of my patients right now, I've known for years, right? So I see them. I see, have they changed? So I can see that subjectively. But folks may tell me, you know what, I'm not walking as quickly as I used to. So those patients, the suspicion would be higher. Anyone who's had a recent hospitalization, and again, I come back full circle, unless there's a reason to be in bed, medical reason to be in bed, you should not be in bed if you're hospitalized. Sit in a chair, do your three laps around the nursing pod with the nurse to, you know, avoid falling. But that's a huge, huge challenge. I'm not doing hospital service anymore, but when I was with the residents, I was militant with them. I walk in on rounds and I see a patient who's in bed, hasn't been out of bed, and I'm like, this is a problem, because the more you're in bed, I always say every day folks are in the hospital, it can take 5 to 7 days to recover. Patients who have trouble getting out of a chair.
I'm not going to do that.
So I woke everybody up?
It's time to react
very
well.
That's okay. Right. Sorry about that. Folks who try to get out of a chair and are really using their arms, yeah, and they can't get out of a chair, patients are at higher risk for having muscle weakness and sarcopenia. And then anybody who uses particularly a walker is likely to have an element of sarcopenia, who's met thresholds. So, in the clinic, those who've had a change in function, those who tell me, I feel much weaker than I was in the past, whoever's lost weight, unintentional weight loss is the key here, of more than 5%. And anyone who has many, many medical problems, those folks are at higher risk. So, this is a complicated subject, as I hope I have shared with you. But why, again, who cares? Why is this important? Well, because sarcopenia is related to function. And you remember the ADLs that I showed you early on? Folks who are dependent on those ADLs versus those who are not have a higher risk of dying in the hospital, higher risk of dying out of 1 year, higher risk of being in a nursing home, higher costs. I've already kind of hammered the point here about bed rest in the hospital. Does anyone recognize what this little contraption is on the right?
Breathing.
Yeah, it's something plastic called an incentive spirometer, where there's a little ball, and folks who are in bed, not getting up, lungs can collapse, increased risk of pneumonia.
Oh, wow.
So this helps open and expand the lungs. So just to kind of recapitulate this and kind of reiterate, your bed rest leads to reduced exercise capacity. The ability to oxygenate your muscles reduces. You lose muscle mass, and you lose bone. You lose bone, it leads to weakness, and the cycle continues. So you need to try to break that cycle. I always ask about pain. I mean, we always ask about pain in our clinic patients, but significant amount of pain, folks with bad spinal stenosis who have significant challenges and they're not moving because of pain. Well, that's a problem because you have pain, you don't want to move, you sit in a chair or lying in bed, you get weaker, you get more pain, you really don't want to move, and it's just a vicious cycle. And it's a downhill spiral. So it's really important to assess for pain and treat pain where needed. Kind of went through this. Okay. I put some slides here on gait speed, and we talked about this. This is the walking speed that I was talking about and how important it is. There are measures and cutoffs that we can say, okay, if you're walking more than this speed, you're going to do fine, you know, or otherwise. So, folks, I had a patient come to me about 2 months ago and said, you know, I've heard you give this sarcopenia talk before. I've read your article. But I want you to measure my muscle mass. So the challenge, of course, is, again, insurances and Medicare won't cover this. But we talked about this. So, and I apologize for not finding a more recent picture, but this is a DEXA scan. So I'm sure many of you in this room have had DEXA scans for osteoporosis. But it's the same machine, believe it or not, that can test for fat and muscle in your body. It's really a software issue. It's a, let's press this button, and now we have more values. Why we can't do this as part of, you know, when you do an osteoporosis screening?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Just a button.
It's just a button.
Jeez.
And you know, we have the software, and having talked to the radiologists here, it's just and our institution's not unique in that. You know, there are, every institution, it's just insurances won't pay for that, unfortunately. So this is the best way to really assess for muscle mass. There are institutes. I know there's one in Arizona. I met someone at a conference 6 months ago. He is a wellness specialist at a spa / weight loss institute in Arizona, and they do DEXA scans on everybody. There are weight loss centers in, there's one in Louisiana, in New Orleans. Anytime they enter, they have a lot of clinical trials to try to get folks to lose weight. They do DEXA scans on all of them, so they're able to assess their fat and muscle mass. Dartmouth is developing a weight and wellness center. I'm involved in that, and my hope at some point is that anyone who's referred there will be able to get this kind of information, because I think this is helpful to both patients and providers. So, some questions that need answering. What is the role of nutrition? The teaser question here, or we'll get to that. What's the role of physical activity? And what are there medications that we can use? And I put this deliberately. A number of my patients come to me and say, I want to lose weight. That's fine, for the most part. But when people lose weight, particularly older adults, when you lose weight, you're losing not only fat mass, but you're losing muscle mass. So you've got to be very, 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 did I mention the word very, careful with that. So 3/4 is fat, 1/4 is muscle. That's kind of the rule of thumb. But losing that quarter of that, you know, a quarter of every pound of muscle can be detrimental to folks. So, you guys okay so far? Any questions thus far?
Keep going.
Keep going. Okay. So when we think about muscle mass and muscle quality, what are, and I apologize for the lack of a clock for you guys to track time. It was part of my master plan. So what do people care about? I think that's the question. Well, it's fine to be able to say, I have sarcopenia, or I don't have sarcopenia. But what do we care about?
Things you can do.
Exactly. And this is one of the challenges that I face, you know, battling with colleagues of mine who are non-geriatricians. In a younger age group, say, our goal is to manage risk factors, high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol. Why? Because we know in 15, 20, 25 years, if they're not managed, heart attack, stroke, and the like. We may not have that amount of time in older adults to worry about that. But folks want to be independent. That is, and again, I stand corrected, but that's my understanding, is independence is high on the priority list. They want to feel better. They want to be able to do a bit more. So I think about what should we be targeting? We should be targeting physical performance. What can we do to improve patients' ability to engage in their kind of daily activities? Other measures, quality of life, falls, social support, you know, and some other markers that probably are less important, but can be considered. But I think physical performance and quality of life are really high up on the list. So, patients at risk of sarcopenia or who have sarcopenia. These are some of the recommendations in terms of what should we counsel patients. So let me talk a little bit about general diet. So there are so many diets out on the market. So many is an understatement. The majority are reasonable. There are a number that are not. In older adults, I'm not a big advocate of low energy protein sparing diets. Why? Because of the previous 50 slides that I showed you. Okay, because that can only contribute to low muscle mass and muscle quality. But then also importantly, your body's ability to manage fluid and electrolyte shifts changes. And homeostasis, so the ability to be able to compensate for these changes, is not as good as, say, someone who's 30 years younger.
Can you explain a bit more? What do you mean by low energy?
Yeah.
Is it low calorie?
Yeah. Very, very low calorie, yeah.
Low calorie, very, like very. They say you live longer if you eat less.
Depends. So so I'm probably skipping ahead a little bit here.
Question?
Look. Well, the study on rats that ate a lot less than normal rats and they lived longer. You know, like, should you starve yourself?
Yeah, but they run happy rats.
and really, what we're finding is that's only one study. Everything is really, everything needs to be in moderation. Mm-hmm. I know.
So don't lower your calorie intake.
I didn't say that.
A little.
So you need to be, and it needs to be moderate calorie reduction. So I have folks, you know, or I'll give you an example, personal anecdote. 6 months before my wedding, my wife and I look at each other, okay, I need to get into my tux. She needs to get into her wedding dress. We have 6 months to do this. So we literally went up, we both lost 10 pounds in 6 months. Why? Because we almost starved. I felt like we were starving ourselves. I was dying. Made up for it during our honeymoon. you know, eating gelato twice a day in Italy. Yeah, but okay. That said,
hey, that's a honeymoon. That's
great. I know. That was my excuse too.
Exactly right.
But really, you know, safe and effective weight loss in certain people is reasonable. But everything needs to be done in moderation. So I always advise folks in audiences like this. If you're thinking about losing weight, to use a particular diet, share it with your clinician and your provider, because everybody's individualized. It's hard to make a blanket statements because everybody is different and it's really individualized. I'm a big fan, and again, not because I'm Greek, but of the Mediterranean diet. And this is a study that was really published in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed that the Mediterranean diet actually folks ended up losing almost 10 pounds.
Over how long?
Over 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's play a little protein trivial pursuit. Only 32 to 41% of females actually have adequate protein intake. Us males don't do much better. And this, according to the recommended daily allowance, is 0.8 grams per kilogram per day, which is a hard number to kind of get your hands around, but this is actually probably low.
In what age group are we talking about?
Older adults.
Okay.
Yep.
60 plus, whatever.
60, 65, I'm not sure exactly, but yeah.
What about all Americans? They're eating too much protein that we hear about all the time.
They're not.
I mean, the big steak eaters, maybe people who are like the burger chicken.
But there was that article yesterday in the Valley News about the virtues of vegetables, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we can get protein from vegetables.
Absolutely.
But that point is played down in our society.
And it shouldn't.
We don't need to have meat.
You don't need meat.
No.
Protein does not equal meat. You can get protein from a variety of different sources, and I'll show you some sources in a couple slides. The other issue here is that as one ages, your body's ability to make your own protein drops. So yes, you can take in the recommended daily allowance, but it's not going to be enough because you're not producing enough within your body to compensate for that. So you need a larger amount of protein to produce an equal response. It's not unreasonable in folks who are weaker or who are at risk for sarcopenia to engage a dietitian in kind of the team-based care approach. And that's something that we often do in our own practice. So elders produce less protein than younger people. Larger amount of protein can produce equal response. So I think the FDA has changed the recommended daily allowance, and it's a little higher. So to give you an example here, these are the kind of the new recommendations in terms of protein. So here, cheeses, eggs, salmon, or fish, those are all protein sources of protein. Supplements.
What about that?
So when I was in residency, my roommate was a buddy of mine from med school. He was doing general surgery, and he never had time to eat because he was up at 4 in the morning and used to come home at 10 o'clock at night. And he had a huge container of whey protein at home, which I tried once, and once was enough for me. The evidence on protein supplements, you know, that you find at the GNC stores is weak. So I can't tell you, yes, there's great trial data that shows that this works. There's some anecdotal evidence that shows that if you take these protein supplements, like the whey protein, which is a powder that you add to drinks, before you exercise, that may actually build up muscle mass and muscle strength. A couple studies have shown that. Jury's still out.
What's the B recommendation?
It may work.
Oh.
So A is you should be doing it. A B is a maybe. So how do you increase your protein? So there are a variety of different ways. Protein bars, there are a lot of them out there.
They have so many calories.
Some of them don't, actually. So, and again, I'm going to put my disclaimer. I have no financial interest in these companies. But, Fiber One, for instance. We have a Fiber One bar as part of when we pack our lunches. It has 80 calories in it. has a good bit of protein in it.
What's the name of that brand?
Fiber One.
Fiber One.
And again, like I said, this is another equal brand. I have no interest in any of them. It's just that's the one that we pack. And I'll tell you, I get up at around, you know, 5:30 in the morning. So by 10:30, I'm use a little snack, and that holds me, usually ties me over to lunchtime. And sure, I ended up trying it as part as a geriatric fellow, because my preceptor, my faculty at that point said, you know, you're going to be telling your patients or advising your patients to use it, so we're going to sit here and you're going to try. So we were four fellows and we had like 10 insurers. You know, it was interesting.
I noticed recently that Ensure has different formulas, and I saw one for muscle. Is it better to use that one than one of the others?
That's a great question, and I'm not sure of that answer, and I have to look at the, you know, constituents, mm-hmm. but got me thinking, and I'll take a look at that.
Thank you. Is there something called beta protein?
Yeah.
Is that better
Where
than
do you
whey?
Get it?
You can get these at any, you know, at pharmacies. Some pharmacies should have them as well. Supermarkets.
But you don't need a prescription.
No prescription.
So the Ensure is good for people, generally speaking?
Usually if you're malnourished or if you are at increased risk of weakness. If you can't take sufficient calories and sufficient protein in other ways, the advantage of the Ensure is it has calories, it has high amount of protein in a low volume. So it's kind of big bang for the buck. Remember him?
Aren't power bars pretty high in calories?
Some of them are.
Okay. Yep. Not all.
Not all.
Okay.
Yep. Does anyone remember him?
No.
So he was my hero at 11:15 at night on a Friday. Because he was a Canadian runner, Ben Johnson.
Yes.
1988. Yep. I was a young teenager and watching the Olympics with my dad at 11 some at night on a Friday, and we were all jumping for joy because he broke the record. And why do I put this up? Because there's some thought that, well, maybe some hormones can help regenerate some muscle. And no, hormones aren't going to get you to be the Incredible Hulk here on the left. Or this gentleman that's in the Sky Mile magazine when you fly in the airplane. Unfortunately, testosterone and growth hormone, touted as may help with muscle, there was actually a great trial put on with a colleague of mine from when I was at Mayo, and it was a null effect. Didn't show a thing. So the jury's out on this. So we're not recommending testosterone or growth hormone for this phenomenon. And it's controversial. You probably have read in the New York Times, Valley News, and the like about risks of testosterone therapy, in particular increased risk for heart attacks and strokes. So vitamin D. I really do believe vitamin D is like the Superman of all vitamins. And it affects a whole slew of different systems here. Everything from mental health to heart to you name it. So a question always is asked, well, I take vitamin D2 or D3. D3 is made in the skin, and D2 is usually taken from oral intake, from dietary intake. And there's a complex pathway whereby there's a lot of biochemical changes that occur in the liver, in the kidney, and then it goes to the bone. So we know that vitamin D increases muscle tone, increases muscle strength, increases your muscle's ability to contract, bulks your muscles up, and it leads to better, more efficient contraction. So I usually routinely check vitamin D on folks, and I encourage folks to use vitamin D. Again, it's an individualized phenomenon with, you know, patient and provider, but we know that vitamin D levels drop with age. So this may be something that's explaining what's occurring.
Is there any downside to taking vitamin D?
There could be. I've had folks that have taken 4,000 units of vitamin D per day, and some people need it. But what ends up happening... what ends up happening, if you don't need it, you get toxic. You get vitamin D toxic. But there are folks that just need the higher dose.
And you find that out by taking a level?
Yeah, you can do blood tests. Yep.
And if it's toxic, how does that present?
That's a great question. Usually you don't know, but it can cause liver abnormalities. Ooh. Because vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin, so it gets metabolized in the liver. I'll be honest with you, I have never seen, knock wood here, a case of vitamin D intoxication. So it's not common at all.
What's the appropriate dosage for vitamin D on a daily basis?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
Yeah. So the question here, vitamin D2 or D3? I get asked this all too often, but it's a good question, because you're in the supermarket or pharmacy, you have D2 bottle, a D3 bottle. So D2, plant-derived, so you can. It's good for loading yourself up. So if your levels are low, it's good to start off with D, because that replenishes the tank. It doesn't fill it, but it replenishes it pretty quick. And then, because then the levels level off after that. D3 is good for maintenance. So it takes a while for those levels. You know, you can still fill the tank up, so to speak. But it'll take a little longer time. So that was last fall, my daughter and I in Florida. And I put this here not because of that ugly crab that's on the beach, but you wonder, well, we live in a northern climate and we're not getting much sunshine. I thought this was a fascinating study. So they looked at people in Florida, older adults in Florida, to see if are they vitamin D deficient. Because I know my wife's grandmother lives in Florida. She loves it down there. She gets, you know, she's up in Pennsylvania 1 month a year, and usually in the summertime too, but she loves her sun, and that's good. But you know, you look at 25% of folks, 40% of folks are still vitamin D deficient in Florida even. So it's not all the sun. Sun is part of it, but it's not all the sun. So when folks come to me and they say, well, I was in Florida for 6 months, I don't want to take vitamin D. You know, it's at the end of the day, I engage patients to make those decisions, whatever they want. I really want to put everything on the table for them and let them decide. But just because you're in Florida for 6 months a year is not going to make you vitamin D sufficient.
And plus it doesn't last that long anyway in your system.
So, again, I come back to a balanced diet. Vitamin D you can get in quote-unquote fatty fish. So, herring, mackerel, cod liver oil, salmon, bumblebee tuna, not my favorites.
Just that particular tuna?
What? Oh, no, I'm not.
Okay.
Just tuna.
All right.
I wondered about that, too.
Yeah.
Question about the salmon. I had a friend who would only eat, she would not eat farm-raised salmon. No. Is there a benefit to farm-raised salmon as well as salmon just caught from the sea?
I both sea and farm-raised. It's the old adage, should you have organic or not organic?
Organic,
okay.
Do I grow my do we grow vegetables in the summer? Sure. Do we buy vegetables where a pepper is this big, where the strawberries are yay big? It's a tough one.
Can I ask a question about that? Going back to the other one, the Atlantic herring is like 1,600 units.
Vitamin D.
And the tuna fish only has 200. That's a substantial difference.
Mm-hmm.
Can you buy, does pickled herring work? Is that still?
Probably has a lot of salt in it, is my guess.
Yeah.
That, and that opens up another issue, of course.
Sardines?
I think, yeah.
I mean, you're Greek, so.
Yeah. Sardines. I'm not a big sardine fan, believe it or not.
No,
well, my family always says, you know, you're not Greek because I don't eat feta, I don't eat olives, I don't eat sardines.
No, you're not Greek.
I'm not Greek.
No.
These are some other products. Orange juice in particular is the big one. Milk, of course. And why is this important? Well, vitamin D, we talked about the muscle issue, but it also, it's been shown to reduce fall risk.
Vitamin D.
Yeah. Unclear as to the mechanism. But this is what you're trying to prevent at the end of the day. So you can see if this is a hip fracture. Mm. See where the arrow is. Okay. And we know that patients who have sufficient vitamin D levels compared to those who don't have lower risks of fracture. So a 22% lower risk of developing fracture. So it's important. Important for bone health. So to your question in terms of how much vitamin D. The Institute of Medicine notes there's insufficient evidence to make a recommendation. Now, what is it? So, translation. It should be, folks should have anywhere between 600 and 4,000 units per day. I always encourage as much as possible to take both calcium and vitamin D from dietary sources, if possible. So I have patients who are not on vitamin D supplementation. And their levels are fine. And that's fine. But if you're engaging in your diet and your levels are low, then you probably need some supplementation. The American Geriatric Society last year has recommended trying to get folks to increase their intake because of the risk of sarcopenia and risk of fracture and bone health as well. We can check levels. Our lab has given reference levels, and you can talk to 10 different providers, and 10 different people will tell you different ways to supplement vitamin D. This is the way I do it. This is the way I was trained. Again, you look at different recommendations. And at the end of the day, most of them are all the same. I usually check once a year or once every other year. The challenge, of course, is what's the challenge? The challenge is Medicare sometimes does not cover this vitamin D unless you have a coexistent disorder.
I mean the test, yeah.
Yeah. So this is my son many moons ago when he had a binky in his mouth and we couldn't get it out. So the most powerful intervention of currently available for sustaining one's strength and improving muscle mass is resistance and weight lifting exercises. Notice, it's all capital. And I like to press the let me repeat myself button. The most powerful intervention currently available for sustaining one's strength and improving muscle mass is resistance weight lifting exercises. And you've seen this, we talked about this. Life course. Okay. So, I'm going to talk very general terms in terms of exercise prescriptions here. These all need to be individually tailored. It is still recommended, regardless of age, 30 minutes of daily low to moderate intensity physical activity. And it's okay to divide this in given bouts, 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there, and the like. Really should be aiming for about 150 minutes per week. For resistant exercises, these are weight-bearing exercises, 30 to 40 minutes, 2 to 3 times a week. And this helps with flexibility, strength, and endurance. The old adage, start low, go slow. The worst thing you can do is to say, oh, I can do this, and not start slow, and next thing you know, you've ripped or torn or pulled a muscle. This is not my idea of physical activity. And it's all about goal setting. So, today, I'm going to decide to be more active. And it'd be great if you guys all left this room and said, you know what? I'm going to be more active today. And if you did that, check. Check the box. Pardon?
I've already done it.
Tomorrow, I'm going to find out about exercise classes in my area. So you see, we're doing baby steps here. End of the week, I'm going to ask a friend to exercise with me. We know social support does help engage people to not only engage in exercise, but continue with the exercise. My wife and I went on an exercise. We started going crazy with the running on our treadmill and doing our exercise bike last summer. And then the holidays came. We fell off the wagon. She had a lot of work. I had a lot of work. And then we looked at each other 2 weeks ago and we said, what have we been doing? And you know, go figure, we're just tired all the time. Well, it's better to get on the treadmill. Now we're getting on the treadmill at 5 a.m. and I got more energy now than I did 2 weeks ago. And my wife's doing the exercise bike as I'm doing the treadmill first thing in the morning. Kids are still sleeping. But you're able to engage with someone else. And that helps so much. In 2 weeks' time, make sure you've gotten clothes and adequate shoes. That's so key, to have good footwear. And have a long-term goal. I want to prevent from developing the sarcopenia, or I want to lower my blood pressure. I want to play ball with my grandchildren. I will swim 3 times a week. It doesn't need to be, I'm going to fulfill all this tomorrow. So you want to have, you know, even if it's a 6-month or 2-year, you know, timeline, that's okay. So patients ask me, well, what's enough? Probably a little too much. And if you're like poor Pavarotti here, singing, probably not enough. So we talked about strength training a little bit. You want to rotate exercises. So you don't want to do the same muscle groups on the same day or consecutive days. So if you're working your biceps, you don't want to do that tomorrow. You want to say work on your legs tomorrow or your neck the next day. And start with 1 to 2 pound weights. You can get, they're very affordable at a local Walmart or what have you. Or if you don't want to go buy, you know, weights, use a soup can, use a milk jug, everyday household items. Start low, go slow, and breathe. You'd be amazed, people don't breathe, and next thing you know, they're flat on the floor. So, you can use a milk jug, Campbell's soup can, free weights. And these are kind of cool weights here, where you just strap it on, and you can strap it on your legs, and it's actually resistance. Right then and there.
Could you go back to the other one, the previous one? I thought, okay, gradual, and then start gradual and add weights and breathe in. Okay. Thanks.
So what is the team's role? What is your medical team's role? Always discuss with your provider, you know, if you're not active and all of a sudden you want to be active. Say, you know what, I want to do this. Talk to them. Anything that is unexplained, any symptoms that are unexplained, I would rather get 25 phone calls than not get a phone call and there's something bad and something, you know, unfortunate occurs. Push yourself, but don't push yourself too much. So, and everybody has to gauge themselves. The goal is really to be fun and safe.
Yeah. I guess there's a couple of questions. One is, type of funny exercise classes. So in terms of strength training, you would go to a gym. But then the other hand, you have, well, let's start with soup cans and milk jugs, things like that. Well, I don't really want to drive to the gym. I mean, it's maybe 20 minutes away, yeah. But I'm retired, but I'm still extremely busy, believe it or not. I got all kinds of stuff going on. So to me, to drive an hour and then kind of go through the whole routine, you know,
tough.
It's like, I feel like I'm wasting it. I mean, I basically, even though I love going, I just feel like I'm so time stretched, you know, to do that. But at the same time, so I mean, how many soup cans? I mean, I guess what's effective in terms of actual strength training, because I'm only doing milkshakes or soup cans, that's not very much resistance. I guess that's my point. Whereas they may have 10 pounds or 20 or 30 pound weights.
So what you need to do, everybody's different.
Yeah.
So you might, you know, want to start off with very low weights and you gradually build yourself up.
Mm-hmm. But even at home, what would you buy a set of weights?
You can buy, you know, if you don't want to go to the gym, then yeah, you buy yourself a set of weights.
Right, yeah.
Or you improvise. I have folks that have, use sandbags, you know, for weights. Stuff around, you know, they had, I don't know,
so yeah,
they had sandbags around
sand
the house.
Right.
Yeah.
You can do a milk jug filled with
yeah.
sand.
Yeah. Which is heavier than milk.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen this?
Yeah.
TheraBands?
Yeah.
Okay. So this provides a lot of different, of significant resistance for given muscle groups. The different colors, and again, I apologize, I always mix up which is the least to most. So I'm not
yellow wrong. Is the easiest, green is harder.
Thank you. But the different colors represent different elements of tension, yeah.
There's a red in there somewhere too.
So these are some exercises. Some of you may know Donna Pigeon, who's one of our physical therapists, that she's shared with me to share with you. But given exercises that you can do on different muscle groups for strengthening. So you can see this gentleman, or this person here on the upper left, is doing a toe lift. And then they use the TheraBands, wrap it around the leg, and then move the leg, you know, out to one side or back. Even going, sitting up and standing up, sitting down, standing up, sitting down. That actually helps your quadricep muscles. And these are some other exercises here that you can do with upper body strength. And you don't need to do this with someone. You can do this on your own, too. You know, if you wrap one end of the TheraBand to, say, a door, you know, he uses that as a crouch. These are some for back and lower extremity. You can see this person is pushing against the wall, leaning down, and stretching their hips. These are good balance exercises. So you want to make sure that if you have an impaired sense of balance, that someone's there with you around, so you know, until you build your stamina and your ability to do so. But it's really, you know, trying to, you know, you close your eyes and you're trying to balance on one foot. Make sure you have your hands near a chair or what have you. I really would highly encourage all of you to take a look at this. The National Institutes on Aging has an exercise guide. So nia.nih.gov, health information, /publications/exercise guide. They have very nice, colorful pictures of all those exercises that I had. But it's a self-read book. Patients who are fallers or have balance concerns, you know, talk to your provider about seeing a physical therapist. We know physical therapy works.
What about Tai Chi?
Absolutely.
Qigong, stuff like that? Would you call that resistance?
It's more balance yeah. exercise. It depends on what other exercise, given exercise they do. The exercise that, you know, the...
Some of it's very slow.
Right.
So you've got to really be...
So it's good for flexibility and balance, definitely.
Yeah.
So, in summary, strength training can really increase muscle mass, muscle strength in older adults. We know that strength can decrease pain by getting folks a bit more engaged. And most importantly, we know that exercise can reduce incident disability. If patients ask me, what is the key to healthy aging? It's really physical activity, folks. It's really what it is. I think we talked about this. So this is, of course, Spider-Man. My son said, Daddy, you're not putting a Spider-Man slide in? This is, you know, someone, phenomenal muscle mass, Usain Bolt.
Yep.
So really, the main goal is to prevent the reduction of this decline. And it's an irreversible phenomenon. It will occur. So your goal is through diet and exercise to prevent this from occurring or to delay its onset. Using of hormones or other medications, it's a matter for researchers. I mean, there are no medical therapies currently that exist. You want to make sure vitamin D levels, physical activity, you can see is a big bubble here for obvious reasons. I didn't really mention too much about mood disorders or depression, but that's something that we encourage providers to address, because that can affect engaging patients in behavioral change. Smoking, I don't think I need to say much more on that. And really increase protein intake. So our population is aging. Sarcopenia is really part of an aging process. And defining this and identifying this in clinical practice has been very difficult, but it does exist, and various people use various ways of identifying it. And really, it's adequate protein intake, vitamin D intake, and exercise in a nutshell that is needed. Thank you.
Okay.
Any questions? Thoughts?
Can you overdo protein?
Yeah. And in certain populations, it's probably not good. Liver patients, folks with liver problems, probably not a good thing. So again, you want to discuss any significant changes with your provider.
What about a vegetarian diet? Do you think that's better than having meat 5 times a week?
Do I think it's better? I think, you know, a lot of it has to do with what is the patient's goals. Vegetarian diet has its advantages and disadvantages as well. You know, meat has iron, meat, and B12, vitamin B12. Oh. See, I'm not doing anything here. So I think everything just needs to be balanced. I mean, that's I have a number of patients that are vegetarian, and I'm okay with that. But it has to be individualized. As long as they're fulfilling their daily allowances of other, you know, essential nutrients, I think that should be okay.
Okay. Wine? Red wine?
So that's interesting.
That's
because
a
there
default
are
question.
That's always
a,
yeah.
what a good
there are some studies that show that the what's in red wine, there's a chemical called resveratrol. That is an antioxidant, and that may be helpful in reducing inflammation. So the anecdote I give about when folks ask about wine, my grandfather lived till he was 97 on a Mediterranean diet and drank his one glass of wine at lunch and one at dinner time, and he smoked 3 packs a day. And he lived till he was 97.
Wow.
I think, you know, everything in moderation. You know, a glass of wine should be fine, again, assuming all else equal, should be okay. Again, if folks are on a significant number of different medications, yes, or, you know, Coumadin in particular, that could get a little tricky.
But can one glass of wine really hurt medications?
It all depends which medications.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, I
give
the...
So who do you ask?
Your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, your doctor's team. Because, I have patients that say, you know what, I want to have my glass of wine with dinner. And they're on medication like Coumadin or warfarin, which can increase levels of warfarin. But if they have their one glass of wine every day, we know the level is going to be constant because their alcohol intake is constant. Any other thoughts or questions? Was this helpful, useful?
Yes.
Very.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I was here yesterday as well, and oftentimes they give us copies of the PowerPoints. Is that possible?
I usually don't give copies, because I use a number of times I use a slide. I think this will be available to be streamed.
Okay.
I think they're taping it, and it is streamed off the Aging Center website.
Cool. There's a couple of things I missed I wanted to.
I always ask the audience any suggestions for improvement that I can improve the slide set. I know there were a number of slides. I deliberately spoke slowly today. Usually I speak a little quicker, but we had the time, so.
I just have a question about the protein level, because they tell you how many grams of protein you should have. I mean, you know, one egg. I mean, you know, pork chop. This. Some nuts. I have absolutely no idea how much I take. No? I mean, nuts, oh yeah, they're good for you.
And this is a challenge, is that, you know, same with weight, you know, folks who want to lose weight. I personally think it's difficult, it's more time consuming. When anyone engages in weight loss, myself included, I write down what I eat and what the calories are. I have a little calorie book, and it tells me everything. But it takes effort. There's no easy, unfortunately, there's no easy way.
You have to look it up to want to eat it then.
But you know what?
That's disincentive.
But it isn't disincentive, because there's
good.
Times where, oh, my wife made a banana chocolate chip muffin. You know, we always get bananas and we never eat them, so she always makes banana bread or banana chip muffin. Mm. And next thing you know, I'm jotting down, oh, that muffin was 130 calories. Yeah. Well, was it worth 130 calories?
Right.
Is there a test to test your protein level in your body?
Ooh. There are proteins in your blood. Albumin is the big one.
Who?
Albumin.
Albumin?
Yep. And that's part of, you know, routine blood work, so to speak. But it's not a great marker of nutritional state. It can be affected by a variety of different things.
So then how do you know that you're not getting enough? I mean, your slides talked about getting 30% or whatever of what you need.
So what you need is basically they did that by dietary intake. So those studies were met, basically had folks jot down exactly what they were eating, and then they figured out then what amount of protein was in there.
What is this book, Execution, that
was on
the slide?
It's a leadership book.
Oh.
It's one of my favorite books that I read as part of my leadership development as a clinical fellow. And I thought it was just, has a lot of good ways of how to engage people to do stuff. You know, not be the dictator, but just to kind of use team approach and team care to further a mission.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I think it's... There's a whole series of books, like Seven Habits of Effective.
Yeah,
Covey.
Are there any current studies that are ongoing that you could use a participant like me or others here?
Great question. There will be. So I am hoping part of what I'm doing is, if all goes well, I should have some studies up and running next year. That's my hope. I'm submitting to the National Institutes of Aging later this year. And if that works well, it's going to be more in weight loss, but weight loss with improvement in function. And try to overcome some of the challenges I think you've raised. Well, I don't want to leave my home, you know, because it's 20 minutes. So I'm hoping to use technology, actually, to do teleconferencing and kind of groups like this in folks' homes. So instead of you coming to us, we come to you.
Like a web streaming type thing. Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love that.
Because when I have to report to somebody, in some sense, there's more of a motivation to...
Well, I mean, even then you can save, or you can have an inventory or whatever, the web streaming, so that way you can refer back to it. Yeah. So if you sort of are missing, because if you're doing a live web stream,
it would be live, because this would be a clinical study.
Okay. Right.
So But no, keep your eyes and ears open for that.
Okay.
I know there are a number of us here in the center that are we're junior enough but senior enough, if that makes any kind of mm-hmm. sense. We're getting there. We're down that trajectory to try to, because that's one of the big reasons I think a lot of us are here at Dartmouth is the sure. academic component, of course.
Have you ever thought of providing handouts for some of the most important slides? It's a lot to be writing down, mm-hmm. you know, and they go fairly fast.
And what I can do is I'm happy to give, to kind of have Rebecca some of the slides, particularly the exercise. The exercises are all available on that NIA web address. What I can do is I can select some of the slides here and maybe give them to Rebecca, mm-hmm. and she can distribute them.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
How do you feel about walking sticks?
Walking sticks?
Yeah.
In what capacity?
Well, I use them because my knee hurts.
Mm-hmm.
But after a while, especially if I've been walking a lot, I find I kind of depend on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I stop using them, and it's fine.
Yeah.
But then, I guess after the winter, I need them again.
Yeah.
But it seems to me it helps with the arms because I use pressure.
So, you know, one of the challenges is that a lot of folks say, well, I don't want to use a cane or a walker, or more the cane, because I don't want to be dependent on the cane downstream. And it's always a catch-22. I'm more concerned about patient safety. So if the walking stick or the cane is
going to... I mean, two sticks.
Two sticks, yeah.
Yeah.
If you think it's going to prevent you from falling, so that's because that's a big, something mm-hmm. big that we're afraid of. The big, akin to that, is the motorized scooter, you know, that you see on TV, which is my nightmare. That is, you know, there's certain patients that it's reasonable, those who definitively have extreme difficulties in mobilizing and who are, say to me, you know what, I know I'm not gonna walk anymore because for whatever reason. But just to get them from point A to point B, that's another way for them not to engage themselves in physical activity, weaken the muscles, and you're back to square, you're back in trouble. So long answer to your question is I think it's individualized. Folks that if it's fear of falling, we encourage. Otherwise, I think it depends. You know, a lot of folks like to have them just for whatever reason, the habit or what happened.
I thought I read that it helps your actual overall, you know, like the cross-country thing that used to have just the feet, but then when you add the arms, it's supposed to help.
And you can do that, or I have other folks that when they walk with weights, you know, ambulating with weights as well.
L.L. Bean makes a wonderful adjustable walking stick. And I've just come back from a country where everything was cobblestones and, you know, I didn't want to fall.
I hear you.
So I use that a lot. It's just great.
They have a number of them. I was actually just in L.L. Bean's store the other day and I passed by them and they have a whole rack of them.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, I've used mine so much that the rubber tip was getting rattled. And I went into an L.L. Bean store and asked if they could give me a replacement, and they said they didn't have any, they just give me a whole new walking stick. It's like a brand new one.
They'll replace anything.
They stick by their stuff.
They do.
Any other thoughts or questions?
I'll just share with the group the tips for the walking sticks are available on Amazon.
Oh, they are?
Hiking poles, absolutely.
They're all the same size?
No, but when you get on there, you'll find multiple different types of rubber tips. Because some places that you go, like Machu Picchu, require rubber tips. And I found I was able to order exactly the right brand for our walking sticks to use in Machu Picchu with an exact fit.
Oh,
And there's some that are generic also.
Well, I thank you all for your attention this afternoon, and appreciate all your comments and questions. And
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry for the clock incident.